Machinists are set to vote on a contract that could decide where the company builds its fancy new airliner. From APM, I'm David Brancaccio. We'll have the global perspective on business and economics in a sec. But first, more than 30,000 machinists could vote today on Boeing's latest contract proposal. At stake is production of the 777X plane, which Boeing said it could move out of Washington State when machinists rejected an earlier offer. The stakes are high for machinists who worry about voting themselves out of jobs. But as Kate Davidson reports, there are risks for Boeing as well.
Under the revised deal, machinists would get an extra bonus and a few other concessions. But Leon Grunberg of the University of Puget Sound says their biggest concern remains.
Losing the guaranteed pension that they had, one of the few last remaining blue-collar workers in the private sector that have these guaranteed pensions.
In fact, the local union didn't push for today's vote. The international leadership did. It doesn't want to risk losing thousands of union jobs to a right-to-work state. Aviation industry consultant Scott Hamilton says moving is risky for Boeing, too. He says the company asked competing sites to basically replicate its Washington facilities to the tune of $10 billion.
I don't see any state in the union that has the ability to go out and write $10 billion worth of checks to build buildings.
There's also the risk of delay. Boeing wants the 777X to debut in 2020, which might not happen if it has to start from scratch. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
There's word today from India that the prime minister plans to retire after 10 years in power. Manmohan Singh is an economist and former finance minister, and he leaves a complicated legacy. BBC business correspondent Samir Hashmi joins us from Mumbai. Good morning, Samir.
Good morning, David.
The economic powerhouse that is modern India was more than probably a half century in the making. But to what extent can Prime Minister Singh's work get some credit for the Indian economy as we now know it?
As you mentioned, he was the finance minister first in the early 90s. And when he took over as a finance minister, India was on the brink of bankruptcy. It was still mainly a socialist country. And it's Dr. Manmohan Singh who took over and opened the markets for companies to come and invest, which really changed the economic fortunes of India. And today, it is, by and large, because of those decisions that it's become an emerging power, economic power in the 21st century.
Now, many countries struggle with inequality, huge gulfs in income. That is a persistent problem for Indian economic planners.
Absolutely. That's been one huge problem for India. Now, no doubt over the last 15 to 20 years since the Indian economy was opened up, a huge middle class or the mid-income group has grown. But at the same time, there's a huge section of the population which does not even get meals two times a day. Though Manmohan Singh claims credit for that, he says that some of the decisions his government took over the last few years has helped in pulling out some of those people out of poverty. Not to a great extent or to the extent they should, but definitely a lot of people have come out of the poverty line and not doing as bad as they were probably 10, 15 years back.
Samir Hashmi is the BBC's business correspondent based in Mumbai. Samir, thank you.
Thank you, David.
Want to see Marketplace live? You can enter to win a chance to join us at the Norse Theater in San Francisco on January 28th as we discuss the new era of philanthropy. Details and rules at marketplace.org/trip. 20 years ago, if you chose to map where most of the world's poor were concentrated, the result was that 90% lived in the poorest countries. But today, 3/4 of the world's poor live in countries that have supposedly graduated to middle income status, places like aforementioned India and China. This has complicated things for aid organizations like the World Bank, which provide billions of dollars of loans meant to help the poor. Sally Herships reports.
Every 3 years, it's graduation time at the World Bank. That's when poor countries find out if the bank is going to move them up from poor to middle income. If residents are living on an average of less than $1.25 a day, the country is considered poor. If residents have more, the country moves up to middle income. And that's when the World Bank cuts off the cheapest aid, like zero-interest loans. India just graduated, but it still has about 300 million poor, which could pose a problem.
Take two groups of poor who are equally poor, but one group happens to live in a country which is above this cutoff, and another group which happens to live in a country which is just below this cutoff.
Ravi Kanbor teaches economics at Cornell.
I can't see how we can make a sharp differentiation between those two groups of poor.
Kanbor says, according to the World Bank's current rules, hundreds of millions could be cut off from the cheapest aid. India got a reprieve, but Ghana, Vietnam, and Nigeria are heading towards graduation. Lawrence Chandy is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says the poor living in middle-income countries do have some advantages.
Number one, they're living in economies which are moving fast.
So Chandy says, even if they're poor today, there's a good chance they won't be in the future.
Secondly, they're in countries either able to access commercial markets for finance or have large domestic resources already, or maybe both.
It is just the different type of support that is most useful for those countries.
Joachim von Amsberg is a vice president at the World Bank. He says the funding the bank provides to middle-income countries is a catalyst for aid from other sources. He says the bank isn't planning any changes. Middle-income countries may pay more interest, but that frees up aid for the most fragile states, where the Brookings Institution's Lawrence Chandy says unstable climates can mean lenders are reluctant to make any loans at all. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And a new reason to link the Sistine Chapel and Pope Francis. Turns out the new pope is also a tourist magnet. Quartz is reporting under the subhead Papalarity that tourists' visits to the Vatican are up 180% in 2013, 6.6 million people between March and December, compared to 2.4 million in all of 2012. Italy gets much of the economic benefit, of course. 10% of the Italian economy is built on tourism. I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.